Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. As the run-up to this election has demonstrated, we are deeply divided. Congress fights to get the simplest of things done because of gerrymandering. Politicians are now choosing their voters. Our system is awash in dark money. And as we end what proved to be the longest general election presidential campaign in our history, many voters appear securely attached to one candidate or the other, no matter what. And many would say this election will decide the future of our democracy. Indeed, it may decide whether we continue to have one. There's also the fact that our system of government was designed in the 18th century. The world today cannot be compared to that time. Among the cures some have suggested are nonpartisan commissions to draw voting districts, congressional term limits, limits on how long Supreme Court justices can serve, getting rid of the Electoral College, and using only the popular vote to elect a president, and more. Here's one you probably haven't heard. Moving to a parliamentary system. That's the suggestion of our guest this hour. Maxwell Stearns is a professor of law at the University of Maryland Francis Key Carey School of Law. His latest book is Parliamentary America, The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy. And he joins us now. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Let me start with a basic question. The founders had experience with parliamentary democracies. They broke away from one. So why, when they sat down to devise either the Articles of Confederation, which was what we started with, and then replaced it with the Constitution, why did they choose three branches of government with checks and balances and a president as opposed to a parliamentary system? I know you're not a historian, but maybe you can shed some light on that.
Well, certainly that's right. The framers had a set of intuitions about rivalries between and among the three branches of government. I describe this to my students as a rock, paper, scissors constitution, and I use that in the book. The idea that for any option that you choose, there's another option that could defeat it or that it could defeat. And the framers of the Constitution had this set of intuitions that if we set up this set of rival games among the branches of government, so Congress, the executive branch, meaning the presidency, the judiciary, and really centered on the Supreme Court, we would have these never-ending rivalries among the branches. And then we'd add a layer to that called federalism, and we'd have geographical rivalries between the national government and the states. And the way Madison conceived this idea, going back to some terminology from a Scottish philosopher, David Hume, the idea would that it would break in control what he thought of as the violence of factions, which we could think of as precursors to political parties. The problem is it never worked that way. Even from the very beginning, it turned out that partisan rivalries overtook this set of rock, paper, scissors rivalries. And even as early as George Washington's farewell address, he actually addressed the concern of partisanship overtaking what people thought at the time of the framing the Constitution was going to do.
And once again, I know you're not an historian, but even when they were debating the Declaration of Independence, these partisan rivalries, these divisions were clearly apparent in what certain parts of the country wanted, and their interests were very different given the fact that the South was agricultural and the North had a different point of view, and we had the founding fathers. One person thought we should have this federalist government where the federal government reigned supreme. Other people wanted to protect the states and their sovereignty, et cetera. Why didn't they recognize that these factions existed from the get-go?
Well, I mean, what they really, it's interesting. It's not that the framers didn't think that there would be factions. I think that what the framers were most concerned with was permanent entrenched factions that would really embed themselves and persist for a lengthy period of time. I don't think they were naive in the sense that they didn't believe that there were interests. I think what they thought, mistakenly, but I think what they thought was that there would be more fluidity in terms of the combination so that we wouldn't have this kind of permanent entrenchment of what ultimately became parties. Now, they were mistaken about that because they set up a system whereby over time we evolved into really clear geographically determined election outcomes, really crystallized in about the 1840s for the House. Of course, the states chosen originally by state legislative assemblies, but then voters, so sort of statewide elections. And although it's processed through the Electoral College, you could think of the United States as one big geographical district. And what happens in that situation is each side realizes that in order to prevail, it has to fracture the opposition but keep its side intact. Since both sides have those incentives, the result is to create two parties, each trying to dominate. And that game between two parties, which really goes way back to the beginning, it's changed over time which parties dominate, but that game has persisted throughout our history and created real problems in the modern era, what I refer to as the information age.
And that's where you begin, this desire not to have factions and the unanticipated arrival of political parties and what that has meant ever since the beginning. And you write, you might have been told that the Constitution's brilliance is marked by its having long outlasted other constitutions throughout the world. That account is grounded, you say, in a larger narrative involving American exceptionalism. In that account, our unique history and our special institutions immunize us from so many challenges that other democracies have faced. There's only one problem, you say. It's not true. Further, you say that we are facing a constitutional crisis, and countering the flawed American exceptionalism narrative is critical if we are to come out of this and emerge as a thriving constitutional democracy. Here we sit at a time when this theory of American exceptionalism is being pushed as something that needs to be taught in the schools to the exclusion of almost everything else. Talk about the challenge here to achieve what you're talking about. This is exactly the inverse of what's going on.
Well, that's precisely right. I mean, we really do have a number of political leaders that are pushing the American exceptionalism narrative. And one of the things I think we all need to realize is that when we speak at, you know, sort of at a high level, it's easy to generate profound disagreements. But I think that as you point out in a more detailed way, what it is precisely that's mistaken about the American exceptionalism account, it becomes irrefutable that it actually is a mistaken account. So there's a couple of points to make about this. One is that our nation very likely survived, thrived, and even flourished in spite of our unique constitutional design. So we could think of other reasons why we did so well. One is that we had the geographical isolation, unlike most countries throughout the world, from foreign military threats. We had the capacity for westward expansion, which allowed tremendous economic growth. We had a constant, steady influx of highly motivated immigrants, and with the westward expansion, of course, a tremendous pain and cost to Native American communities, and we also had the original sin, of course, of bringing people here under the most brutal imaginable conditions as enslaved persons and maintaining them here under a state of abject horror and brutality. And What's particularly interesting to think about is the United States has exported democracy throughout its history. It has never successfully exported our system of democracy. So when we think about the success of systems, whether we're talking about technology, we're talking about the arts, we're talking about democratic systems, the better test isn't whether we can find an isolated example of a system that endured for a really long time, replicated nowhere. The better test is replication. Is the model that we're talking about one that's been replicated again and again and again? Because if it has, and sometimes even copied outright with technologies, with forms of art, that implies a profound wisdom and soundness and adaptability. The fact that our system's never been successfully exported means that there must be some other reason than its unique design that accounts for that duration.
In previous conversations, and we've had these conversations about our democracy and where we came from and how it developed, and the Constitution and how it is essentially our Bible, and the Supreme Court in terms that either originally or they adapt to it, but etc. we always end up saying, well, it's the greatest document ever written next to the Magna Carta and perhaps even eclipses the Magna Carta. And yet you say, well, if it's that great, other countries would be using it and no one is using it. What does that tell us? Does it say it's a flawed document? Does it say it only works here? It only works here because of all the things that you mentioned about westward expansion and having 3,000 miles of ocean on either side of us so we couldn't be trifled with? Is that why it worked?
I believe so. I believe that that we have endured and thrived not because of our unique constitutional design, but in spite of it. And I think people need to understand that. I think we have to revisit the things that we've been told since we were children that are not true. I think it's vitally important that we properly diagnose the pathology giving rise to our constitutional failings. And living under this mythological story that we've been told since childhood isn't going to let us do that. In other words, you can't prescribe the right cure if you haven't identified the underlying pathology, which is two-party presidentialism. So I think what you've said is precisely right. We have thrived not because of our unique constitutional design, but in spite of it. And we've got pretty strong evidence of that, because if it was such a special document, we would see it replicated across the globe, and we simply do not. What we see for highly successful democracies are systems of parliamentary selection of the head of government and proportional representation. Now, there are bad ways to do that, there are good ways to do that, but that's the general model of successful democracies throughout the world.
We're going to get to your thesis that we should shift to a parliamentary system in a moment, but because the Constitution has served us, I suppose it could be argued, relatively well for over 200 years with bumps along the highway, which would happen with any system, I would assume. It's scary to trifle with it. Although Thomas Jefferson said there ought to be a new constitution every generation. We've never done that. We don't want to do that. What are the dangers of making these changes? Because people have suggested we have a constitutional convention. And of course, you can make an amendment to the Constitution in the convention, or you can throw the baby out with the bathwater and start all over again.
Well, that's precisely right. The subtitle of my book is The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy. We've come close to a convention twice. In the 60s and the 80s, we were within one or two states calling for a convention. The way to amend the Constitution, there are two ways to do it. Two-thirds of the states can call a convention, or two-thirds of each House of Congress can propose an amendment. And then the amendments that would come from the convention or come from Congress have to be ratified by three-quarters of the states. It's a high bar, and we can talk about that. But one of the dangers of a convention is that you don't know what you're going to get, right? In other words, you could literally have any number of proposals thrown out that may not actually solve the constitutional crisis. What I argue here is that the vast majority of proposals out there to reform our democracy either will not solve the constitutional crisis we're facing, or they cannot be enacted, or most typically both. And what I'm proposing here are three amendments that, even if we had a constitutional convention, could be a vital pressure release valve for Congress, because my amendments uniquely motivate highly empowered political actors, members of the House and Senate, ultimately to back them against proposals that might actually displace them and displace their power. So one of the things we need to think about is how to bring folks on who have the authority to enact or to block amendments.
Of course, the stakes are very high here, because we're not just any country. We're the leader of the free world. We're the most powerful superpower in the world. And if you make changes that significantly alter how this all works, we could endanger the entire globe. We'll come back and talk about this with Maxwell Stearns, author of Parliamentary in America, in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Maxwell Stearns is with us. He's a law professor at the University of Maryland School of Law in Baltimore and author of Parliamentary America, The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy. You and many others say that we are currently in a constitutional crisis. You say that this is our third constitutional crisis. The first was when the Articles of Confederation were replaced by our current Constitution. The second was during the Civil War and just prior to it. And this election has been compared by historians to the 1860 election. Back then, we had this deep divide, but it was geographic in nature. The southern states wanted to secede over slavery. The northern states wanted to abolish it in the territories. Now we have these philosophical differences. They're not along geographical lines. It would be much more difficult to split things apart because both sides are everywhere, all over the country. Could it be argued then that what's happening right now with the constitutional crisis we have now, and with your reason for writing this book to change the system of government that we have, that the crisis we have now is far worse than what we faced in the Civil War?
Well, I don't want to say it's worse than something that cost our nation hundreds of thousands of lives, really as the means final to end this brutal institution of slavery. I don't think we need to compare horrors that way. I think we can say that they're both really profound crises, and we paid a tremendous price to successfully bring an end to slavery, to keep the Union ultimately together, but with hundreds of thousands of people killed, and even beyond the deaths, obviously, just it wrought havoc in our history. And then the aftermath was incredibly painful, because although we had the Reconstruction Amendments, the Reconstruction period itself ended far too soon to actually effectuate its goals. And in some instances, it took 90 or more years to actually further the objectives associated with ensuring the full extension of rights to formerly enslaved persons. So I don't want to say it's worse, but I will say it is as profoundly significant, and it equally justifies as serious a response, hopefully one that doesn't result in any kind of actual violence in the form of a war. But all of these crises have something in common. They all arise from a fundamental discord, or what I call a disjuncture, between the premises of the system under which we were operating and the vital needs of governance of the day. And what we're experiencing now is two parties that, although once they overlapped rather considerably, are growing further and further apart, to the point where, although we used to regard others with whom we disagreed as having looked at common sets of facts or materials and in good faith coming out a different way, we no longer do. No matter which side you're on, you think that those who disagree with you must either lack basic intelligence or they must be evil. And this has contributed to our inability to govern. It has sown great societal discord. And what we're seeing essentially is a deepening and widening division across two groups that, as you identified, are defined more by ideology than by geography, although there are ideological correlates. There are greater incidence of different mindsets in particular parts of the country, but it doesn't divide as neatly. You can't draw a line the way you could in the Civil War. Even then, it was a little complicated with Maryland, but Maryland being in the Union, despite being a slave state, I mean, I happen to be in Maryland, yeah. but we could set the occasional anomaly aside. You're right, it doesn't divide as evenly, and that does add to the complications.
Well, Maryland stayed in the Union because I think Abraham Lincoln threatened to burn Baltimore to the ground if they seceded. So I think that was
I am in Baltimore right now.
That's right. So how have we gotten to this point? Why? Because you're exactly right. One side views the other with deep suspicion, fear, and loathing, and have called them. People have called the other side, no matter which side you're on, evil. How did we get here? You date this back to the 90s, I think.
Well, that's precisely right. If you look at the Pew Research data, what it shows is that beginning in the information age, the early 90s until now, two parties that once considerably overlapped, their centers, their modes are just growing increasingly far apart. And that's going to continue to happen. And although our system has had two parties from the beginning, this idea that the goal is to fracture the opposition, keep your side intact, that gives rise to two parties, it really became profoundly problematic to the point of being dangerous in the information age as a result of two sort of synergistic problems, two problems that compounded each other. One of them arises from what is called the red map strategy, hyperpartisan gerrymandering after Obama's first election in 2008, when Republican operatives realized that for pennies on the dollar, they could throw money at below the radar state legislative races, flip enough blue and purple states red. And because state general assemblies draw the districting maps for the House of Representatives, they would be able to entrench a Republican majority in the House of Representatives. They thought for 30 years, they overestimated a little bit, but as a result of this red mapping, which was sometimes met in blue states through blue mapping, right? It is the case, as you said in your very introductory remarks, that our legislators, our members of the House of Representatives, pick us, not the other way around. Actually, House races are no longer competitive. Now, that's not precisely right. They're not competitive in the general election. They are competitive in primaries, but the threat of being primaried by somebody who will feed the base only makes the parties grow further apart. The other fundamental change has to do with the manner by which we receive news and news-like content through social media. And the business model of social media, whether we're talking about Facebook or Twitter or other sort of social network providers, social media providers, is to keep folks married to the screen, right? Really actively engaged. And the way to do that is to give them affirming content. I feel really good about myself. My tribe is right. Or just the opposite, right? Content that sort of allows them to denigrate the other side, as opposed to kind of up the middle, thoughtful stories that give us balance. We don't get that. Our feeds get dominated by this kind of hyper-partisan extreme content in this sort of synergistic loop between really ideologically driven media to an increasingly ideologically divided base, to increasingly divided politicians, and it just keeps going, is causing these parties to grow further and further apart. That is the crisis that we are experiencing, and it requires radical reform to fix.
So I'm going to talk about your prescription for change here, this parliamentary America idea, but how is that fixed? By going to a parliamentary system in which there are more than two parties. There are many, there could be many parties. And we've witnessed how divisive things can be, even recently in Great Britain with Brexit. How does it help to have multiple parties in control of the government?
So the centerpiece of my book is a virtual world tour. I take the readers to England, France, Germany, Israel, Taiwan, Brazil, and Venezuela. And what I demonstrate on the tour is that the twin threats to democracy are either having too few parties like us, like the UK, think Brexit, happy to talk about Brexit, or on the other side, having hyper-fragmented parties, too many parties like Brazil, like Italy, like Israel. What we have to achieve is what I refer to as the Goldilocks principle, the idea that we have to have more parties, but not too many more parties. We have to hit that sweet spot, which most political scientists think of as between 4 and 8. So the thing about a two-party system like ours is, it's not that we don't have third parties. It's that we face what I call the third-party crisis. And the third-party, the third-party dilemma. The third-party dilemma is that in our country, when you vote for a third party, you are voting against interest because you're very likely to be voting for a spoiler, somebody who throws weight to the opposite major party candidate, the one that you least favor, or what I call a randomizer, somebody that will pull in votes from both sides, rendering the outcome a roll of the dice. My proposals allow third parties to emerge and thrive so that when you vote for them, you're rewarded for doing so. And so that those parties, when they form parts of governing coalitions, will actually provide you as a supporter of that party a meaningful benefit. And we have to do that to give more choices so that we don't just continue to see two parties continuously denigrating each other, growing further and further apart.
So you looked at democracy or parliamentary democracies in many different countries, the ones you just mentioned, all over the world. Your proposals for change, are they a compilation of that? Are you cherry picking the best of each of those democracies? Or is this a whole different idea based on your broad knowledge of how this has worked elsewhere?
So it is cherry picking, to be sure, but it's not cherry picking in the sense that I'm choosing a perfect democracy and making it ours. There is no perfect democracy. One of the premises of the book, I actually say it right up front, is that both as a matter of theory and as a matter of experience, there is no perfect democracy. And in fact, I'll go a step further. Every democracy embeds what we can think of as anti-democratic features. That's an inevitability. But it doesn't mean that we can't do democracy better, that we can't learn from nations that have successfully or unsuccessfully faced down their own threats to democracy. The system that I propose is an adaptation of the system that was invented for Germany after World War II. It's called mixed member proportionality. And it confronts the two vital choices that democracies have to face. One is how you elect the lower legislative chamber. For us, it's the House of Representatives, and how we select and hold accountable the head of government. Of course, that for us is the president. And the choices along those two axes of democracy fundamentally affect whether you can have a viable system of third parties that give those parties a meaningful role and reward voters who support third parties as opposed to punishing them as we do now. But I want to be clear, I am not taking Germany's system and just imposing it on us. It is the title of the book, I talked about the subtitle, the title of the book is Parliamentary America. I'm advocating a parliamentary system, but a very American parliamentary system that retains so many vital features. I do not propose ditching and starting over. I propose fixing the system we have to make it a highly functional multi-party system that we can proudly leave as our legacy for future generations.
Yeah, you're not proposing ditching the Constitution, but you are proposing adding three amendments to the Constitution.
I am.
Three electoral reform amendments. The first would involve reconceiving the House, changing the system of how we elect the members of the House. The second would deal with how the president and vice president are chosen and how they can be removed. And the third amendment, I believe, deals with the Senate. You call this your Parliamentary America proposal. So let's start with the House of Representatives. Except for extreme partisan gerrymanders that lead to minority rule and politicians picking their voters as opposed to the other way around, what needs to be fixed?
I just wanted one modification. My third proposal actually is about removal of the president through a vote of no confidence based on maladministration. It actually isn't about the Senate, although there is an added power to the Senate in the very First Amendment. So what needs to be fixed is we have to create a set of institutional structures that allow third parties to emerge and thrive. Right now, third parties, as I said, we have third parties in our two-party system, but they play a confounding and deeply problematic role. My amendments are designed to give third parties a meaningful role and to reward voters who support them. So the first of the three proposed amendments doubles the size of the House from 435 to 870. So when you go in and vote every 2 years, you'll now cast two ballots, not one. One will be by district, just like now. So those folks will actually keep their seats in the districts that they presently have, which many other proposals would not do, would actually deliberately displace them. But you'll also vote in the second ballot by party. So let's say that you're a progressive Democrat. In the districted seat, you're likely to have two dominant parties for the reasons I previously talked about. Each side wants to divide the opposition, keep its side intact. You might choose between the Democratic Party and the GOP. But then for your party ballot, if you're a progressive Democrat, you'll vote for the Progressive Party or whatever its counterpart is. Let's say you're a traditional Republican. you'll vote for the GOP in the district election, but you might want to either vote for the regular GOP and say, just don't form a coalition with America First or MAGA. I might be willing to have you form one with the Democrats. Maybe a grand coalition of centrists between the Democrats and Republicans would be the best. Because beneath our parties, there are really the makings of at least four, probably six parties. The Democrats probably break into the traditional Democrats and progressive. The Republicans would break into traditional Republicans and America First. There might be a Green Party. There might be a Libertarian Party. And what you'll be able to do is signal who you want to have lead the coalition negotiation. That's the Second Amendment. And the direction you want it to take. So suddenly, with real precision, you can say what you want, unlike being admonished every 4 years to vote for the lesser of two evils. You'll have much more power to send meaningful signals as voters, and then we can talk about the other amendments. But that's the first step in the fundamental change.
So when you double the size of the House, you're still sticking with proportional representation in the House. So if we have 10 representatives right now from North Carolina, we would have 20 and two
yes.
votes, one by district, one by the other. I'm not sure what to call the
by
other.
Party.
By
the other
party.
Would be by party. And then what we do, so let's take a state with 10. Washington state also has 10, doubles it to 20. What happens is you then look at the sum of the second ballots by party, and then you allocate the state's entire delegation based on the proportional representation. So just to give a very simple example, let's assume we go from 10 to 20, and let's assume that in the district seats, Republicans get 5, and the Democrats get 5. But let's assume that in the proportional vote, each of four parties gets 25%. Progressives get 25%, Democrats get 25%, Republicans get 25%, and America First does. So what happens is you realize, okay, the Democrats and Republicans picked up their 25%. 5 out of 20 is 25%. They don't pick up any additional seats. But because the proportional votes are 25% each, we now give 5 seats each to these other parties that didn't get adequate representation. And North Carolina or Washington send 5 seats each to the House of Representatives. The math won't be as neat as that in every state because we've got different size state House delegations, but it will achieve sufficient proportionality that no party will predictably get a majority, and they'll have to form coalitions with other parties to govern.
And I want to come back and ask you why that doesn't lead to more gridlock, and we'll do that when we come back, and we'll also talk about your proposals for how we elect the president and vice president, which are perhaps the most radical of all of this. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is law professor Maxwell Stearns from the University of Maryland Law School, my alma mater. Point of full disclosure here. He's also the author of several books, the latest of which just came out last week, Parliamentary America, The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy. And that's what we're talking about this morning. We're just talking about revamping the House of Representatives and doubling its size from 435 to 870 members with people from various parties, not just Republicans or Democrats. That's certainly how it may not start that way, but that's how it would evolve over time. Why would that not lead to more gridlock and more slowing things down and inability to respond to the needs that we face on a daily basis?
The reason is that it would give a basis for genuine party competition. See, the problem with the party system we have now is that because each side seeks to fracture the other and keeps its own intact, neither party can afford to give up any part of its natural constituency. So when somebody comes in like a Donald Trump and has a base constituency, MAGA, that becomes a part of the Republican base, the kind of mainstream conservatives, they can't give it up, because if they do, they throw power to the Democrats. If the Democrats had an extremist who came in, the Democrats wouldn't be able to give it up, but they'd throw power to the Republicans. My system creates a basis for genuine party competition where these parties will break into more than more than two parties, we'll end up with between four and six parties, as I previously said. Not too many, not too few, but just picture the campaign differences. Imagine that you are running for office in the system that I'm proposing. You would not be able to succeed by simply denigrating the other side. The only way to succeed in this system is to campaign on a platform that embraces a willingness and even enthusiasm for joining forces with others to say, you know, there are other parties. I don't agree with them on everything. In fact, I might profoundly disagree with them on some things, but I can work with them because I know we share a common interest in having a highly functional democratic system of government. And we can work together to effectuate common goals. Imagine how different that kind of a campaign is going to be than the campaigns we have now.
What would you
and
do
I'll just add one, okay. if I may, just one
sure.
thing. When you vote for a third party, that third party, if it forms part of the coalition, is going to demand from the head of the coalition, I'll join your coalition, I'll let the head of your ticket, pre-designated ticket, assume president and vice president, which is the way it would work. If you give me and my constituents some policy concessions, some appointments at the cabinet level, or even the first seat that becomes available on the court, suddenly when you're voting for those third parties, you're not punished by having voted for a spoiler or randomizer. You're rewarded. You're going to get something in return because that party, to be effective, is going to deliver it to you.
What would you do about the Senate? Because right now people are complaining that North Dakota has the same number of senators as California, which could be a country unto itself, quite honestly. So would you change the makeup and how it's proportioned?
So I'll give the two examples. Look, the Senate is the single most anti-democratic institution in any country that claims to be a democracy. So I like to give the example of Wyoming. If you're a Wyoming voter, your vote equals that of 67 Californians. And if you take the 21 smallest states, which get 42% of the Senate, their populations together equal that of California, which gets two senators, so 2% of the Senate. So it is an egregiously anti-democratic institution. However, I go back to the subtitle of my book, The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy. You see, when we become a multi-party democracy, although it is true that in Senate races, you'll have two parties dominating those races because the same sort of dynamic about keeping your team together and fracturing the opposition pervades state senate, U.S. Senate races from states, it doesn't mean the same two parties will dominate the country as a whole. So in other words, we may have more dominance by two parties in particular parts of the country that aren't the same as everywhere else. Over time, the Senate itself will become a multi-party institution. And there are problems with the Senate. But solving the Senate will not end the constitutional crisis we face. Later in the book, I talk about a number of other reforms that I very much like, that I would very much support. And once we become a functional, thriving democracy, we can take on those problems. And there are a couple of proposals I give about the Senate. But what I wanted to do in this book was to say, this is what we absolutely must do to emerge from this crisis a thriving democracy. And then once we do that, there are other problems, some of which we'll foresee, some of which we won't foresee. And we don't want to make the mistake of trying to fix problems that might fix themselves or failing to anticipate problems that we can't foresee. The goal is to fix the pathology and emerge a thriving democracy, recognizing there will be other problems and we'll take those on in due course.
The area where things get really sticky, I would think, or maybe people will take issue with, is what you suggest on how we choose going forward the president and the vice president. In your Second Amendment, you suggest that having elected party leaders in the newly constituted House of Representatives choose, this is like going back in time, choose the president and vice president by forming a governing coalition. Sounds very much like how prime ministers are chosen, but the prime minister is not both the head of state and the head of government in most of those countries. So flesh out your idea. What is it exactly?
So that's quite right. What I'm proposing is a system whereby up to five parties on a fixed calendar with pre-designated slates for president and vice president would negotiate majority coalitions based on proportional representation. So the party that gets the most seats would do it first, then the second, until a majority coalition forms. The party leading the coalition will have its pre-designated president and vice president candidate assume those offices, so voters know what they're getting with respect to who's leading the coalition and what would happen if that party leading the coalition succeeds. But the idea here is that right now, we have a choice between the lesser of two evils in every presidential election cycle, where people are admonished to basically pick the candidate they regard as less bad. And we think we're gaining power by voting directly for the president, but real power in a democracy isn't about making the ultimate choice between two options others have foisted upon us. Real power in a democracy goes to having significant influence over what those choices are and how they come about. And so this negotiation process that I embed in the Second Amendment of my proposal gives voters actual meaningful input into who is going to run the government, and not just with respect to who will be at the head, but also what the coalition is going to look like, what its direction is going to be. As I said, so if you're a progressive Democrat, you signal the direction you want it to go. If you are a somewhat more moderate Republican, you signal the direction that you want it to go. So this truly empowers voters, and I'm convinced that if you ask folks in other systems whether they would trade theirs for ours, we wouldn't find any takers around the world.
But isn't the problem right now with the Electoral College? Once again, it's not unlike the Senate. It's giving the weight of the vote to people in rural states where there are fewer people. It's all about the Electoral College count. If you just eliminated that and there was direct election of the president by the people, wouldn't that be a cue to the parties that the people chose this person who stands for X, Y, and Z, so you folks in Congress better get on board? Because it's the only office that everybody votes for.
Yeah, so I think that a lot of people think that there are these simpler fixes, but I'm quite certain that there are not, and that simply eliminating the Electoral College will not fix the crisis that we face for a very important set of reasons. Getting rid of the Electoral College in favor of a national popular vote will solve one problem, which is what I refer to as upside-down elections, where the popular vote diverges from the Electoral College outcome, as occurred five times in our history, twice recently, one with the Al Gore George W. Bush election in 2000 and the Hillary Clinton Donald Trump election in 2016. You see, but what the Electoral College, there's one benign thing that the Electoral College does, which is it produces a kind of harmless error problem for elections. So in election 2000, there were four states in which there were serious disputes about electoral processes, but everybody knew that three of them didn't matter, but Florida did. It only mattered what Florida did, because whichever candidate got those 25 electoral votes would win. Imagine that we eliminate the Electoral College in favor of a national popular vote. Suddenly, votes everywhere in the country are equally weighted, and suddenly we'll still have a two-party system because of what I talked about before, keep your side intact, fracture the other side. Suddenly the incentive to suppress votes, to contest vote outcomes, will arise and persist across the United States. We may invite more anti-democratic behavior by the GOP, which is an increasingly minority party, and we may end up with even more intense divisions.
Let me see if I understand your system. You are suggesting that we double the size of the House, that the House chooses the leaders of the House, choose the vice president and the president through a voting process that takes place after they are elected. We don't choose the president and vice president, but we do know who they would choose if they are elected. I guess there's no way to hold them to that, but let's just say that they will stick to what they said. How long does that process take? In other words, we have no president because his term of office is up, and we're wrangling in the House about who to elect next. How long does that process take, and who's in charge in the interim?
So I have to be clear, there is a way to hold them to that, because one of the features of that Second Amendment is that the slates are pre-designated, and some parties will continue to hold caucuses and primaries. So voters in those parties will continue to have an influence over who could be at the top of the ticket for parties that choose caucuses and primaries. Others may do it in a different way, and that's good. We want competition between and among parties. But unlike other parliamentary systems, my system operates on a fixed calendar with a backstop. So although there are parliamentary systems that just endlessly cycle and we don't end up with an actual outcome, I have a backstop and it's on a fixed calendar. As I said, the title of the book is Parliamentary America, Emphasis on America. We are the largest economy in the world. We are the number one superpower in the world. We have to be able to have a predictable schedule of government, and we have to be able to hold ourselves out as a reliable partner to other nations across the globe. We can't afford that kind of uncertainty and endless negotiation. One of the reasons why it's pre-designated slates is to avoid the possibility of just keep throwing in options and never getting to a resolution.
But we can't afford the gridlock we have now, and the fact that one administration or one Congress says we'll support Ukraine and the next one says, nah, don't think so. We're going to support NATO. Nah, don't think so. We can't afford that either.
But this breaks that gridlock. It doesn't facilitate it. It ends it. Let me explain. So Kevin McCarthy steps down. Everybody knows that moderate Democrats, moderate Republicans could have gotten together and come up with a solution without going through the painless vote after vote after vote in the Republican Party until they finally settled on Johnson. Instead, we weren't able to get the moderate Democrats and moderate Republicans together because there was no institutional mechanism to accomplish that because, once more, the goal in our two-party system is fracture the opposition, embarrass the opposition, keep your side intact. Suddenly in this system, moderate Democrats, moderate Republicans will have separate parties and they can come together and form a grand coalition that could work for funding Ukraine. It could come with respect to funding in other foreign affairs. It could come with respect to domestic policies on reproductive rights, on racial justice, on gun reform, on any number of issues, where there's a clear, overwhelming majority of Americans that favor particular policies but are thwarted by our two-party system. So contrary to imagining that what I'm proposing adds to gridlock, no. What I'm proposing solves the gridlock problem.
So I have about 3 minutes left, and you have a proposal for how we would choose the president and vice president going forward. Congress would still, all the terms would stay the same. The president would be 4 years, limited to 2 terms. The same thing would be true of members of the House and Senate, although you are proposing perhaps term limits down the road. But when
I'm actually not proposing term limits, but go ahead. No.
Okay, when a new Congress comes in every 2 years, what's to say that they don't like the president the last Congress chose? So he gets ejected or she gets ejected through a vote of no confidence, which would replace impeachment. Why wouldn't that cause even more turmoil in the world's largest economy and the leader of the free world, the most powerful superpower in the world?
Because the third of my amendments anticipates that and embeds a structural mechanism to make it highly unlikely that simple disagreement with the president on policy would provide a basis for removal for maladministration. I set the bar higher than that. It's 60%, which means if you've got, say, a majority coalition in the House of 51%, let's say, or 52%, in order to get 60%, you've got to get a significant percentage of that original coalition to go along with the opposition. That is a high bar. It's a lower bar than impeachment. We could finally have a basis for removing a fundamentally problematic president, which we've never had. But it is a sufficiently high bar that it's very unlikely that you would simply vote out somebody because you disagree with them on policy.
I have a minute left. You're proposing 3 amendments. Let's just say members of Congress and other people in politics agree with you. They read the book. This is a good idea. Let's do this. What happens if only one or two of those amendments pass and not all 3? What happens then?
Well, I think that the first two are really the most vital. I think they go together. I think that we would realize the need for the second upon the passing of the first. And I also think that the third would naturally follow. In other words, I think that people would recognize that this is a package and they would be voted that way. And that's certainly my hope.
Have you talked to anybody in Washington? You're right, you're 45 minutes away. Have you talked to anybody in D.C.? about this?
I have not spoken with a high-level office holder, if that's what you're asking. Okay. But I certainly hope to be doing so.
Okay. Maxwell Stearns, author of Parliamentary America, The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.